Good morning. You're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Form, commercial free, community based radio. And for the next couple hours, you're going to be hearing a part of that community slice. It's going to be socialist alternative radio, talk, and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And your host today will be myself, Jeff, and we will be talking about the all sorts of things. I mean, some things you've been hearing about in the corporate media with, Medicare for all. We're approaching the one-year anniversary of Trumpism, stuff like that. But we're also doing a going a little in-depth today. It's the 100th anniversary of the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. 1917 was the day of the Russian Revolution. We'll also be talking today about some things happening locally in terms of organizing for socialism, organizing for socialist alternative, organizing for an alternative to capitalism. And so it's kind of and we'll be talking, if we have time, about what's happening in Catalonia, which the corporate media, at least over the last few days, has not been covering very much. There's an independence movement in Catalonia. It's been going for a while, and it's reaching a turning point. We'll be talking about North Korea a little bit, also a socialist running for office out in Minneapolis and what that means for the rest of the country and so on. And we want to thank you for tuning in. Again, you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. And we're also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And we're going to take a short, I have to do this technical thing. Hold on, please. We always hate the dead air sound here at WMFO, but no co-host today, no interview today, no engineer ever. So it's DIY radio to a certain extent. And there's something I had to do I forgot to do, and I just got it done. So the sound is going to be a little better now. Again, if you just tuned in, this is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other week, and we hope to be here as the new semester and new schedule kicks in every other week from Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are, as in addition to our tagline, we're talking about socialism, not in just the sense of bringing you an alternative perspective and view on information and news and so on, but we're also here to encourage you to actually get involved in the socialist movement, to get involved with building socialism, building socialist alternative, if you wish. For example, a majority of millennials reject capitalism, millennials. And in a UCLA survey last fall, 1 in 10 incoming freshmen said they expect to participate in protests, the highest in the 50 years they've administered the survey. We've, on this show, tracked polling data from Pew Research from another polling data company names that you might have heard of. And the results are pretty interesting. Starting from after the Occupy movement, some polling companies started to track it's a broad question, but it's basically like, what is your attitude towards socialism? Positive, negative, that kind of thing is the kind of question they usually poll on. And so, that depends on a little bit on people's definitions of socialism, which are all over the map, granted. But let's say there's a certain percentage that get it right and a certain percentage that are very close to what it means. And it's still very, very impressive because you're getting outright majorities among certain sections of the population, among youth, among people of color, and even places you wouldn't expect it. There was one poll that apparently was asking people their political affiliations, a la, U.S. parameters. Are you a Democrat or are you a Republican? That's all that exists apparently in the world, in the U.S. world. And so sometimes they throw it independent. Never ask me though. I'm one of those people that, is dubious of polls. Not really. I'm just kidding. But I am dubious of them. It depends on a lot of methodology. But I'm one of those people who never gets asked a polling question, and therefore I don't, wonder, who's getting asked all these polling questions all the time? It's not me. So who is it exactly? Not people I know. So anyway, but leaving that superstition aside for a minute, let's go back and say, well, you know, I have heard and read about them, and in, when it comes to politics in the United States, they like to keep everyone corralled into a very narrow path, and that would be Democrat or Republican or independent. And a lot of the independents voting Democrat or Republican when it comes down to it, because of the tried and true lesser evil strategy of the ruling class, which has them laughing all the way to the bank, by the way. And basically, I've never bought into that. Even before I became a socialist, even before I joined Social Alternative, something in me didn't like the parameters, the rules, the choices, the authoritarian nature, really, when you get down to it, of being told in so many ways, this is all you have on offer. And I discovered there are candidates out there, hard to find, hard to hear about because of the corporate media being owned and, of course, by the big corporations, which profit from the duopoly of the Democrats and Republicans. But there are out there independent left candidates criticizing capitalism, socialist even. There are green left candidates criticizing capitalism. Some green lefts are socialist. There are some people you can vote for if you dig hard enough in certain elections. And I don't believe you have to vote in every election. I try to do that. And if there's nobody to vote for, I'll write in, you know, Leon Trotsky or Fred Hampton or, you know, Malcolm X or something like that, you know, just to mess with their minds a little bit. But I don't have any illusions that does anything. I do like the concept of voting. I do like, a lot of working people have, you know, protested and fought for that right to vote, even if it's completely controlled and constricted, or almost completely controlled by big money and corporations in this country, and very, very constricted. I think that in a socialist society, we can open up voting and democracy in ways that are unimaginable under capitalism. I mean, in other words, you'd be discussing and voting on what's to be done with our own labor, our own brains and hearts and hands, and what do we want to spend our time doing to create the necessities of life and have a decent life for everybody, a good life for everybody. Voting on economic decisions that are now called economic decisions, that are called private decisions because of the private ownership of the means of production of goods and services, of things that people need, commodities and services. That's considered somehow, even though it's socialized production that affects everybody in society with millions of people working to create things and add value to things that capitalists then say they created or own, which is a complete joke, then, you know, for us to make these decisions instead of allowing just a few capitalists at the top to make those decisions, that'll be a very, very different society, very extremely different society with extremely different power dynamics. And basically, bringing democracy to the economy, what's going to be produced, how it's going to be produced, how it will be distributed, and for what reason. Is it just going to be distributed after all that democratization of production for sustainability, given what capitalism is doing to the environment, to destroying the environment, essentially, at least for human habitation, given that we feel power, that we exercise power over our own will, our own labor power, our own labor time, do you think the result of that will be then to say, let's give it all to Bill Gates? Once people understand fully they are the ones doing the work and creating things, once working people understand their own power, do you think they then say, okay, let's give it all to Donald Trump? No. Of course not. Many working people have woken up to the fact that the system is unfair, that capitalism is ridiculously unfair and damaging and wasteful. It's a damaging and wasteful system, a dangerous system, in fact, a system prone to war, a system prone to racism and sexism, a system that thrives from racism and sexism, a system that thrives from inequality. It can't be any other way under capitalism. Malcolm X said you can't have capitalism without racism. Hint, hint. The upper middle class leadership of some movements that claim to be against oppression, they've forgotten that now. But remember Malcolm X, you can't have capitalism without racism. Think about that one. Read up on MLK, what he said about capitalism and the connections he made, especially towards the end of his life, about before he was murdered. I don't know why I make that sound like natural causes. That, you know, Malcolm X, of course, and King, as they're getting more radical, of course, become more of a threat, and they were murdered. by right-wing elements that maybe with collaboration of the government, that's debatable in terms of how far you would bring that the word collaboration out to creating the conditions for that. Like when I was growing up, this is a little digression here. We got a lot of them on the show. Bear with me. When I was growing up, the way that Martin Luther King was dismissed in my working class, primarily white neighborhood that I grew up in, was he's a commie. Commie was the catch-all phrase for dismissing anyone as not only beyond the pale, but worthy of violence and death and everything. And that, you know, not everyone felt that way. I didn't. I don't know what happened to me. I don't know if it was Star Trek or later on The Clash or something. I just didn't. The experiences I went through, you know, seeing how unfair basic hierarchies are under capitalism, everything from bullying to the authoritarian nature of the school system, just always rankled me, always bothered me. Oh, I never felt right. And even at times when I was very young and embraced sort of a conservative, nationalistic culture in my working class neighborhood, I would take that a little further. You know, I'd be like, well, what about libertarianism? What about Ayn Rand? You know, when I was, you know, like, you know, entering junior high, for example, you know, you know, even the conservatives would be like, what are you talking about? You know, and I'm talking about what you're talking about. No, you're not. That's what I don't understand what you're talking about. And then by complete accident, getting introduced to left-wing ideas through reading a lot. But not, by the way, not Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky, Luxembourg, Angela Davis, whoever. You know, I didn't have it for some reason. Didn't run into. No one introduced me to left wing theory. You know, and hardcore. You know, I wish I had read State and Revolution when I was 14. I didn't know it existed. I didn't know the Russian Revolution existed. You know, and so quite accidentally. Through right-wing critiques of socialism, believe it or not, plus reading like progressive science fiction, again, stumbled upon accidentally while reading also reactionary science fiction, I start to piece together bits, you know, that there's this thing called left-wing something. Anarchism was the first thing I thought I you know, knew about, you know, and did actually become an anarchist when I was quite young, you know, in beginning high school, reading anarchist works, which were easy to get a hold of, actually, you know, relatively speaking, not much of a threat, anarchism, really, when you get down to it. And so I'm reading, you know, this anarchist stuff I'm finding in my high school library. Of course, now, are there any high school libraries left? I don't really know. There's not too many, I guess. And this is before the internet, not that I think the internet is necessarily going to lead people to discover new things, given the you know, it's still dominated by the market. So, you know, yeah, you can read, if you're trying to find left wing essays and stuff, you can find a lot of them in the public domain on the internet, but a lot are going to be blocked by paywalls, or they're going to be books that aren't you have to pay for to read electronically or whatever. So it's not a solution to what I experienced, but of course things are a little better now. Little stress on little as far as getting alternative information. So anyway, the point I'm leading up to is that I had this everything sort of going against me to end up being a socialist. The Cold War, an older stepbrother in Vietnam, and you know, and all the commie this, commie that stuff, and arguing with teachers about what, you know, was Newark and Watts, were they riots or uprisings? It was actually some of them where I was too young for, but there was later riots, so-called riots, that I would say, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And the teachers would actually say to me, you know, give me some sort of racist explanation for the rioting. Is black people killing white people? And nothing about the conditions and so on. So basically, if I can become a socialist, you can become a socialist. You know, I mean, I had everything mitigating against me in terms of that, except for being working class. But in the United States, of course, class consciousness is very low. People identify themselves as workers. I mean, we had a public meeting, Socialist Alternative, at a public meeting in Worcester last week, and it went really well. It was a very good meeting. We had 60 people there. We had a very good discussion, had people afterwards interested in joining Socialist Alternative. So it was all good that way. But the discussion also veered into some weird directions when, you know, two different people, I'm sorry, this is a different meeting I'm referencing now. Sorry. That meeting, that what I'm about to say didn't happen. It was another meeting that was at Worcester State University. I think there was about 20, 25 people there. And again, very good, a good turnout for Worcester State. Good turnout, a good discussion, great speech and everything by a member of Socialist Alternative. And then in the crowd, these two people, an older person and a younger person, I mean, much older, like someone that lived through the 60s, and then also someone younger, clearly, you know, 20 or something. They both got up and said at different times, "I'm a capitalist." And then when they went on to describe, because they were really into themselves, very highly egocentric, describe their own wonderful personal philosophies and how wonderful they were, which people tend to do in the United States a lot, because, you know, we're taught individual survival strategies is the way to go, and we're all special. We're all special individuals pursuing our special. You know, we're not told you will chase money unless you're one of the less than 1%. Your life's going to be spent chasing money, trying to sell your labor to some rich idiot. And you can dance around that all you want, but that's what you're going to do. And even if you become one of those rich idiots that can then exploit someone's labor, you're part of that exploitation. Yay. You're part of that degradation and destruction of the environment. Yay. You know, so anyway, these two people that clearly were not capitalists, no capitalists ever come to a meeting of Socialist Alternative, I'll tell you that right now, unless they're out in Seattle wondering why there's 500 people packed in a city hall demanding rent control or something, and Shama Sawant, a member of Socialist Alternative and a socialist, leading that charge. Unless you're there to spy, we don't get capitalists at our meetings, okay? So this guy was an old hippie, actually, was up there saying, yeah, I'm a capitalist, and I did this and that, and, you know, and I don't know what his point was, really, except he liked to talk about himself. But the point I'm making is, dude, you're not a capitalist. A capitalist is someone that owns capital. This is money, tons of money invested in to make more money for yourself, you know, to invest it either in something that produces a commodity or a service, or someone that is sitting on money. In that case, you're not really a capitalist. Capitalists actually don't sit on their money. They actually use it to make more money, or use it to invest, to get other people to work for them to make them more money. So you're either sitting on that money, you're just some rich guy. But very few of the elite, of the top less than 1%, just sit on their money. They invest it, which is a nice word, they use it to exploit more labor and more natural resources, more labor, more nature, to make even more gobs of money than they can ever spend or use, for the most part. And they and that's who the capitalists are. We're talking about the top section of society. And then there's small capitalists, in Marxist terminology, petty bourgeois, which means small bourgeois, or small capitalists. And they're out there too, but they didn't even reach the small capitalist stage. They didn't even reach the small business stage. These two that brought up, that said they were capitalists, one clearly, the younger guy talking about libertarianism, the older person, the hip ex-hippie talking about living through this and that and so on, and what wonderful, just so smart. I think the person actually said, "I'm very smart," or something like that. Watch out when people say that. anyway, so we had to, you know, live through a few minutes of how smart the guy was and what a capitalist he was, and he's not a capitalist. And you know, this system of capitalism is not understood by most capitalists. They understand aspects of it in terms of making money, or they get other people to do their thinking for them, which is more the case. And they might understand their little part of that, of the capitalist system, in terms of yes, I'm very good at you know, getting other people to make personal computers, and then getting other people to sell them, and then I take credit for all that because, you know, I thought of some aspect of marketing personal computers or something like that. You know, this is the typical capitalist of the United States. But ask them, you know, hey, what's going on with capitalism? How come most of the world lives in poverty? How come there's all these wars? How come there's so much inequality and racism and so on under capitalism? What, you know, if this is such a great system, why is it continuing to, as Marx called it, immiserate people? you know, if at one poll a few are getting enormously rich and wealthy and have more money than they could ever spend, why does the vast majority of people get poorer and poorer in relation to that? Et cetera, et cetera. You know, you could go through all the problems under capitalism. Why would education funding be cut in the richest country in the world? Why would drugs be, pharmaceutical drugs that are available, why would they be priced in such a way that they become unavailable and people die because they don't have enough money for a drug that's out there? You know what I mean? One part of the meeting at Worcester State that we had, this was a meeting entitled Capitalism versus Socialism. I actually stood up and you know, I made this speech. I don't know if it was good or not. But it was in depth. I quoted some statistics and so on. It was somewhat in depth. I didn't have much time. And at the end, I was like, you know, some of this comes down to, in a way, a sort of common sense about where history is going and where things are leading. In a way, all we should have to do is say, climate change. Poof. Then you say, oh, I'm a socialist now. I understand. I understand there's no way out of this climate change problem and global warming and the vast amount of pollution that is constantly spewed out by capitalism. There's no way to get out of the train wreck that's happening with the environment and vis-a-vis human habitation and human life on the planet without an internationally planned economy, including democratically planned, including making decisions, obviously, that will go against the short-term maximization of profit. Short-term maximization of profit being the god of capitalism. This is what they all either swear to or they try to deny, but end up doing everything they can to fulfill that. I mean, even in the United States, you have actual laws of incorporation, laws that corporations must follow, where if your actions are deemed not in the interest of increasing the profits, maximizing the profits of the shareholders, then you can legally be removed and punished for being a CEO that refuses to cooperate with that scheme, which is the essence of capitalism. You know, that and calling social production and social and land natural resource private property when clearly it cannot be used in the way the capitalists are using it by one person or even a small group, that it takes thousands and millions working together, unfortunately being exploited under capitalism, to extract, refine, use all sorts of natural resources. We have the situation in the United States, to retie the original knot here, sorry for the long digression, where class consciousness is very low. You have workers going around calling themselves capitalists. You have capitalists not understanding what capitalism means. And, what is the answer? Is the answer that we all have to become versed in every last aspect of the methodology of dialectical materialism, which is the basics of the science behind Marxism and socialism and so on? It wouldn't hurt. Try to learn as much as you can, obviously, about socialism. As Marx said, ignorance never helped anyone. One time Marx was accused, hey, Marx, because Marx mixed it up with the people. People don't understand that. Marx went to union meetings, and he went and talked with a lot of people. And he lived very poor himself, even though he came from a upper middle class background or middle class background. And so, he was used to mixing it up in the pubs and so on, and of London and wherever. one time at a union meeting, someone called him out and said, you know, I don't understand, Karl or brother Marx or whatever, comrade Marx, whatever. I don't understand why you're using such big words all the time and create and talk about these concepts about economics and so on. You know, people don't understand this stuff. And, part of what a Marxist would say is that, well, yeah, people actually do understand this stuff. It depends how you put it to them and talk to them about it and discuss it with them and show them that their own experiences are part of this theory. Like one time Marx said, someone asked Marx, what is Marxism? He said, it's the collective experience of the working class. They expected him to say it's this or that theory. It's the collective experience of the working class. But, yes, analyzed with a certain methodology and with a certain goal in mind of equality and so on. But back to this accusation, hey, Karl, you're using these two, Karl Marx, you're using these big words. What's up with that? Why are you doing that? He basically said, well, ignorance never helped anybody. That sometimes you have to use the big words. And people are very capable of understanding and learning things that the elites in society, the people that are the capitalist class, or those that do their bidding for them at the top. You know, the pundits, the intellectuals that sell out, which is most, almost all, the et cetera, the people that are a propagandized for the system, for capitalism, they will create a situation in their minds and propagate it that there are the, you know, the basically kind of severe prejudice against working class people in general, not to mention their usual accompanied by racial prejudices and so on, but basically saying that, well, you know, a lot of us, you know, I come from a very working class background. I got this thing on me personally, I'm talking about for another little digression. I got this thing on Facebook the other day from a member of Social Alternative. He was joking around saying, I guess he was forwarding this, put two words, what did your grandfather do? And then a word you don't quite understand, and this will be the name of a new beer, a new craft beer. This was kind of clever, so I indulged. And I thought about my two grandfathers, neither of which I knew because they died early, were both factory workers. So I'm like, oh, well, that's not much choice, factory worker. And then I put insouciance, which I don't know what that means. I wish I did. I used to know probably, but I don't know what. Don't call with, this is what insouciance means. I'll look it up. I didn't bother. Anyway, that's the name of the new craft beer for me. But anyway, I'm like, wow, two grandfathers factory work. Father, truck driver. Mother, I don't know, secretary, clerical worker, something like that, when she was working. Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like again, mitigating against me is everything under capitalist society. I'm going to be exploited, which I have been. I have my labor exploited and so on. Got into college, you know, barely in the sense of being, we didn't know how we were going to afford it. I was going to go into ROTC. I did 1 year of ROTC and I'm like, this is not for me. The officers are bat crap crazy, number one. That's one thing, one truth about the TV show MASH. There's a lot of untruths and a lot of weird things and lies in that show. But one thing is true is that the tendency for officers to be crazy is something I experienced in my short flirtation with the Army as a year in ROTC. And then also, of course, I was getting more political and more left-wing, and I couldn't see going off to fight for imperialism. Just didn't make any sense to me. And the two things were like, okay, I got to get out of this. And there was a way out. You know, the first year in ROTC is voluntary. They gave me the runaround, but I finally like sort of occupied the major's office, said, I'm not leaving till I get my form. I forget the name of the form. It was a form that you signed to say in the event of war, you could not declare yourself a conscientious objector because they were bringing back the draft then. And so I wanted that little piece of paper back. So if you know, they started a draft, I wouldn't, they say, hey, oh yeah, you denied any right to appeal your draft status and get, you know, get your butt over to, you know, wherever the next incursion will be, would have been back then, you know. Back then it was like Panama, Grenada. They were just reasserting themselves and the imperialism was reasserting itself in the Western Hemisphere first before going out to the Middle East again. But anyway, so yeah, I got the piece of paper. We had a little, me and my friends, a little ceremonial burning in the sink of that nasty document. But you know what really got me out of ROTC was because starting before I went to college, starting in high school, I started working in a big factory. Yeah, thanks, Grandpa. Thanks, Dad. You know, you pushed me into that lovely occupation of factory work. But unlike my grandfather, one of my grandfathers at least, and possibly the other one, unlike them, I was working in a union factory. I was in the bakery workers union, working in a big General Foods factory. And I, through the union, was able to, because of the union and the wages at the time, late 70s, early 80s, was able to save enough money living at home, ridiculous commute, ridiculous hours, being what they call in the, what they, we used to call an overtime whore, which I totally admit to, sucking up every bit of overtime they forced me to do or that I had volunteered for. Most of it was forced overtime until we went on strike and stopped that and actually won a strike over that and a lot of other stuff. I was making enough money to realize I could afford college plus go into debt like everyone does now. I did that way back when it was not as fashionable, I didn't go deep into debt, but I went into debt enough that because I had crappy jobs leaving college, It still took me 15 years or something, ridiculous amount of money to pay off a rather small debt load. And voila, college, instead of, you know, the craft beer thing being factory work, you know, I was putting in, actually, I would have to put in a lot of weird jobs. But anyway, but class consciousness, you know, I sort of lucked out and ran into socialism and found out more about socialism and got involved in alternative politics that I had to dig for, you know, left-wing independents, left-wing greens, socialists, you know, et cetera, running for office here or there. And also having to really work for hold on one second. Just had to take care of something here. Wow, that didn't take care of it. Anyway, having to like work for, you know, getting involved in the socialist movement, of course, then reinforced being a socialist. And when it wasn't so, when there weren't as many people interested in it as there are now, and it wasn't as popular. And so I developed this class consciousness, you know, based on my circumstances, where I came from, what kind of work I did, and then actually being conscious of it and reading about that kind of thing. But you know what's lacking in the U.S. It's not a failure of U.S. working people. It's not a stupidity or something like, again, the elites like to say we're not capable of this or that as working people, understanding this or that as working people, which is hilarious because if you look at colleges, they're very elitist, of course, still to this day. I heard a ridiculous statistic the other day, a horrible statistic, that like 73% of the richest colleges, and I'm not sure, that was a pretty broad category. The richest is not quite the word they used, but it was like private maybe or something. They used some sort of criteria, but 73% of the students going to the richer schools do not come from poor backgrounds, which I interpreted as working class backgrounds. And yet, I think they were focusing on Amherst College. This was on National Propaganda Radio. I wish I'd gotten a copy of the transcript, but at Amherst College, they're apparently using more of the endowment for financial aid than a lot of other schools, and they've upped that to like 40-something percent or whatever from this low 17% or whatever, very low percentage, 13%, I don't know. Anyway, I'll come back in the following week with these stats worked out. But basically, you get the percentages here are ridiculous. It's still in the United States where you have a lot of people going to college, but very, very, but that includes community colleges and colleges that are not well funded, obviously. And then even at the non well funded colleges, the community colleges and so on, you have a lot of people not finishing. The United States has this high rate, relatively speaking, under capitalism. And I, you know, I'm using this in quotes, high rate. Everyone should be able to go to college that wants to, and that's not happening, obviously. But you have a high rate of people going to college, but a ridiculous rate compared to other countries of people not finishing college. I'm talking about advanced industrialized countries, of people not finishing college. So like you're up to like 55% going to college, but it goes down to like 25 or less percent finishing college. And now the ones that are finishing college, a lot of them are finishing with these huge debt loads, which is a whole bubble in the economy now, the student debt bubble. But getting back to that question of class consciousness, which I think is key, especially if you get involved in the socialist movement or not, or just looking at it from outside and you're saying, hey, you know, I don't really see the people lining up for a Patriots game or something, they're not going to do revolution or something, you know? First of all, you might want to think more about what the question of revolution means. You know, it's not just some sort of cliched, violent, episodic, sudden thing. It can be, it's a process, you know? And this is the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. If you bother to study that, which I would encourage everyone to study that from, you know, the few left-wing sources that are around, the people that are going to actually tell you the truth about the revolution rather than the right-wing sources, which I've read a lot of them, and they leave, the right-wingers like to leave out this huge democratic movement called the Soviets, the workers' councils, that actually empowered the revolution and empowered working people and raised class consciousness to tremendous heights. And basically you have the situation where the working people, at times historically under capitalism, do actually reach that class consciousness. But one of the things that happens in that process is the existence of political parties that are out of the control, more or less, of capitalism. I'd say more, or totally out of control. That the working class has, through unions or through other organizations, fought hard and create socialist organizations, whatever, fought hard to create a political vehicle, a political formation in societies that are that then working people routinely, and even to this day, this is the true in a lot of countries, even where some of these parties have been co-opted by capitalism. You have, you know, in the history of capitalism, say, for example, social democratic parties in Europe that started out revolutionary, then working people have a place to vote or something to think about that they know. They're even taught in school sometimes that this party was started by workers, by people like you, and to fight the system, capitalism. Oh, there's a system? Capitalism? Oh, me? I'm a worker? You know, these questions are often not asked in the United States. They're not posed in, you know, in public schools often in the United States. You are miraculously without a social class. You're just sort of bopping around as an American, and Bill Gates is an American too, and, you know, Donald Trump is an American too, and, you know, all these people that live lives of loud indulgence instead of lives of quiet desperation, like the rest of us, chasing money, of course. The aliens have landed, basically, and they are called the capitalist class in the United States. Now, unfortunately, a certain number of people, including a certain number of working people, just voted to put an alien in office, Donald Trump. I find it ironic that Donald Trump was part of this birther movement about Obama and so on. You can criticize Obama a lot, but this whole birther movement thing was clearly racist. And someone like Trump, who truly, from my point of view, is an alien. It's like that movie They Live from the 80s, that John Carpenter movie. You should definitely check that out, where once you put these special glasses on, you could see, and the people seeing were workers, you could see the suits, the elites in society were actually aliens, and that there was a signal making everyone see them as you know, just the rich or the elite, normal, quote-unquote, rulers over us. But again, without that vocabulary, the workers didn't have that vocabulary that they're elite or they're rulers, they're different necessarily, you know. Having a political party or political parties to the left of, say, the Democratic Party in the United States, to use as a marker, or to the left of the Liberal Party in Britain, to a party that's funded by unions and by working people, a party that has progressive, at least, if not anti-capitalist and socialist principles and so on, and methods. You know, the existence of a party like that, even for a time historically under capitalism, creates a class consciousness to a certain extent in a lot of countries that, while, you know, waxes and wanes, it is there some more than other times. It's usually more than in the United States, where we're brainwashed from birth that, you know, we're all Americans, you know, and the real triggering mechanisms for us are saying the pledge of allegiance to the flag, or listening to the national anthem, you know, at every sports event or race car event or something, written, by the way, by a slave owner, Francis Scott Key. You know, and we're taught this mythology about the United States, about United States history, and so on, and that becomes like ingrained. It becomes like a trigger, a switch you can turn. The bourgeois can turn on and off. You know, hey, they need more control over the oil producing regions in the world, mainly in the Middle East, or Venezuela, as it is as well. Turn on the switch, get the flag waving. You know, it's like the so-called discussion. What an overused word. So-called debate, also overused, unfortunately, in the United States, where Colin Kaepernick and others, other athletes, are getting a social conscience, getting political. Thank goodness, it's way past time for that, and it's brilliant. Taking a knee when the national anthem is played as a protest against police brutality, against racism, against the oppression of black people and others. You know, of course, we love this. You know, we just love that they're speaking out. And by we, I don't just mean me personally. I mean which would be odd. I mean, I'm not royalty. I don't refer to myself as we. But anyway, it's a socialist alternative and so on. So this is a great phenomena. And of course, the thing they put on the corporate media, which you should be suspicious of, a lot of people support the people protesting, using the ritual, use of the national anthem, protesting during that, things happening right now, in terms of police brutality, racism, etc. I think that, and Trump, of course, has just inflamed that with his, fire them all and all that stuff. Even LeBron James, I mean, multimillionaire now, says, Trump's a bum. Absolutely right. absolutely right. I mean, that was just like, you have to give LeBron James credit, despite everything else, you give him some credit there. He just really, Trump is a bum. And it was great that he had the courage to say that. He'll lose some endorsements now or whatever. So this, we're taught, and then I see on Facebook from people I know from, where I come from, my family and so on, who are like, putting out these patriotic memes and wishing the worst on the fire them, do this and that. And then the corporate media tying it into soldiers, tying it into veterans. I don't know. I come from a family where a lot of people were in the military and, a few of them at least. And I did my year in ROTC, which doesn't really count, but but being in that military, military environment, and so on, a few of them at least would say, it's their right to protest. By the way, and you might find one or two veterans in the protest, as you usually do, in our sort of protest movement. Even with the volunteer quote unquote army or the economic draft they have now in the army, huge sections of the United States. Youth get caught up in the military and they don't come out with the cliched version of flag waivers and the whole way we're brainwashed to not question the goals of U.S. imperialism, capitalism, and nationalism and so on. And, but that is a powerful tool in a country where that knee-jerk nationalism inculcated from when you're an infant practically is a powerful tool. In a country where there is no obvious political alternative to the two pro-capitalist parties, the Democrats and Republicans. That's a powerful tool to keep people in line, as is religion, of course, and funding the religions, giving them tax breaks, But that's class society since the slave societies have used religion to keep the ruling class in power. Capitalism has perfected that, of course, with its subsidies of religion, its invocation of religion, in a mass media context, a mass corporate media context. So you turn the switch on of nationalism, you turn the switch on of religion, and a lot of American brains are going to react automatically, and yet a lot don't, right? So what happens? Well, it's lived experience as a working class person, and I mean that in the broadest sense. Most working class people, by the way, when I use that term on the show, the first thing that comes to mind is not the cliche of an older white factory worker, although I've been in that world as a young person actually, and as helping out with union drives, union organizing. But that's not what jumps to mind, and it shouldn't. Objectively, what should jump to mind is actually a woman of color, a woman who is, Latina or black or whatever, not just in the United States, but worldwide. That's the majority. The majority of the population is women. Now, not every country is industrialized where it has women in the workforce, but, so-called domestic work is still work, makes you part of the working class. Anyone that wants to or has to sell their labor to survive, that's part of the working class. Now, there's huge sections of capitalism that don't function, huge areas that don't work, and you can't sell your labor, and you're reduced to subsistence farming or subsistence barter to survive. Those are still workers, If that situation changes, the minute there's a drought, they're going to have to become migrants. The minute there's a war slashing through their areas, they'll become migrants, immigrants, who are our brothers and sisters, by the way, and our comrades. They're not the problem at all. And if you're wondering what that means, yes, social alternative is for amnesty of all undocumented people in the U.S., for example, and in other countries. We're very pro-immigrant. It's ridiculous that these are capless borders. You know, we understand the you can't like eliminate all borders immediately under capitalism, but you also can make life. We can force social programs and benefits to make life bearable and better for immigrants as we fight for fundamental socialist transformation. Under socialism, no borders. There won't be any borders. How can I say something that categorical? Because if socialism is going to work, it's going to have to be international, and the planning of the economy on an international basis, and borders just get in the way of that. Under capitalism, borders are lovely because the capitalists use the nation state and national armies and laws emanating from the United States, for example, on copyrights and all that to make zillions and zillions of dollars in profit. Where's Carl Sagan? Carl Sagan, I think, by the way, was a bit of a socialist, or maybe a socialist. Remember that billions and billions thing when he was trying to get you to understand, get me to understand the stars, how big the universe was? Well, to understand the obscene profits of the capitalists on a world scale, but using the nation state as a battering ram to get more market share, to exploit natural resources, to use the army and so on to enforce its will, its economic will on those that might resist. All that, is part of the sort of capitalist, the hidden parts of capitalism that aren't always out there on display, but exist very, very clearly if you're on the receiving end of that. So class consciousness, the general theme through what I've been talking about, it's not a question of stupidity versus intelligence or necessarily a question of will. It's a question of conditions, and if there's a political party that can speak to and give space to working people figuring out their interests are not the same as the ones exploiting them, the ones using them for profit. It's also the way things are going historically. You know, if the system is not working in a lot of countries, which it never has in most of the world, capitalism has never worked, but those countries are repressed, are poor, are kept down by U.S. imperialism and British and French and so on, imperialism, colonialism first, then imperialism, then there's the it's very, very difficult for those countries to obviously develop at all, but even to pose a threat to the world order, the capitalist world order, you know. And so you have a situation where we're taught that capitalism in the United States, especially capitalism, has always existed. There's been no other economic system, which is completely ridiculous. Capitalism has actually been a tiny part of human history. Most of human history were tribal societies, hunters and gatherers, then some farming thrown in. Once the farming got big enough, then you started to have surplus. Once you had surplus, you started to have class differentiation. And first slave societies, then feudal societies, now capitalist societies, and the intermix of all those at certain points in time. Now, the point is, though, that most vast majority of that was not even slave society, was not even feudal society, was not even capitalism, which is about, 300 years old, maybe. You had instead, at some points in discussing this from a left-wing perspective was called primitive communism. But really, tribal societies, that fits, but, you know, tribal societies, the equality was based on scarcity, though, not based on abundance, which we're going to have if we achieve a socialist society, a communist society in the future. But right now, it's like, if you look back just objectively, most of human society on a time scale was hunter-gatherer societies with some agriculture thrown in towards the end of that time period. To say capitalism always existed is just freakishly wrong and absurd, but we're taught that. We're taught that that's the reality. And there are some very smart people, quote-unquote, PhDs and all that, who will teach that history, that capitalism always existed. They'll look at tokens of value. They'll look at money that was had a very limited role and limited value, and they'll say, "Oh, look, they had money. They had these things they exchanged." You know, it's like the way they talk about Native Americans and North America and wampum and so on. This was a ceremonial sort of gift-giving thing. It's in an equal ownership of land. It didn't equal capital. Capital didn't exist. It didn't equal ownership of money, capital. It didn't equal ownership of anything, really. There were very strict limits as to what you could get from using it. It was not a universal commodity the way money has come to be under capitalism. And there was no societies before capitalism with a universal commodity in that sense. There was constrictions, even in feudal societies, although it was approaching that. Anyway, without getting too much into the theory of where money came from and all that, getting back to the main point that, you know, the way class consciousness formed, if you're thinking of getting involved in the social movement, you say, well, people just don't get it. They don't even know they're workers, a lot of people. In the United States, they think they're just like to quote the famous, what is it, Sinclair Lewis or John Updike? There was a famous author. I think it was John Updike or Sinclair Lewis who said, the reason we'll never have socialism in America is because American workers just consider themselves temporarily embarrassed millionaires, meaning that they haven't yet become the millionaires they expect to become, and so on. And that that strikes a chord, right? You know, we all want to win the lottery. I'll admit that. I'm conditioned that way, too. Although I don't spend much on, do lottery very, very rarely. And usually I'm very disappointed, which was quite a surprise, huh, given the odds. But anyway, there's a grain of truth in that. But why John Updike or why Sinclair Lewis? Why is that? You know, go a little further. Well, excuse me. Lack of a workers' party is a big, the lack of a left alternative that would, by its existence and by its propaganda and by whatever education it did, could actually educate people about and create resources for alternative media, alternative education, and so on. People all of a sudden quickly, based on conditions, based on the existence of an alternative political view out there and propagated in a mass way, all of a sudden, wow, Americans are extremely class conscious and people in general, and ready to change society. And, you know, that conditions push that along. Even if that left political alternative is not built yet, there is incrementally in the United States more class consciousness, more acknowledgement and understanding of inequality, a lot of it based on fits and starts in mass or in social movements that unfortunately haven't become mass movements but did make an impact. Occupy, for example, the anti-globalization movement before Occupy, the people that are now fighting in various, like the anti-police brutality, Black Lives Matter movement, and so on. There are many examples of, you know, and even in a micro way, but important, we point to Shama Sawant getting elected in Seattle. This is a member of Socialist Alternative. Her name is spelled K-S-H-A-M-A, second name, last name, S-A-W-A-N-T, Shama Sawant getting elected as an open socialist, open member of Socialist Alternative, not only getting elected in 2013, but getting re-elected in 2016 to a city council seat in Seattle, one of the major cities in the United States. And by the way, we're going to get into Ginger Jensen, a member of Socialist Alternative, running as an open socialist, open member of Socialist Alternative, running for office in Minneapolis. These are small, historically speaking, victories, very large victories within those cities. Ginger hasn't won. This is a situation of running, and we're not predicting she will definitely win, but there's a good chance of it. And Ginger Jensen running in Minneapolis right now. The fact that a socialist group like Socialist Alternative could get enough of the elements together necessary to take on big business, including money, donations of like $7 average from people and so on, from many, many people, is absolutely brilliant. A sign of the times, the growth in socialist organizations, or many socialist organizations, like Democratic Socialists of America, claiming, you know, membership, 28,000 or something like that. And now that's largely, there's problems with how that's measured, but, you know, it can be just a paper thing, but it can be real, and there are big meetings. DSA having big meetings around social alternative growing since Sharma was elected and reelected. Also, the reaction to Trump, the mass movement, the mass women's march, many, many protests, the protests that have been happening recently in St. Louis against police brutality, police and racism of the police force and so on. These are a lot of movements that I've mentioned that didn't reach that sort of mass movement status or capability or you know, power, but were significant, very significant movements, some of which are still in motion. And we'll see where that leads. I'm going to switch gears now, as I promised earlier, to talk about some things that have happened recently, some things that are going to happen. Basically, 1 year is enough. Did you remember, did you know that coming up in November, there is the one-year anniversary of Trump getting elected? Now, if you're listening to us criticize Trump on Social Alternative Radio here, you may be like, does this mean a de facto support of lesser evilism and the Democrats and all that? No, it doesn't. I mean, we are analyzing the Democratic Party and seeing rifts in it, like a lot of people are. Even the corporate media comments on this, that you have, like when Sanders entered the Democratic Party, when he works with the Democrats, he's raising issues a lot of them don't agree with. There are people out there that call themselves progressive Democrats. There are, there are people that probably in the future will drop the Democratic Party, many that have dropped the Democratic Party. So yeah, there's change happening, but we don't consider it a change that indicates the Democratic Party can be reformed. That's been tried many times, and it's impossible because of the where the money comes from, the structure of the Democratic Party, and also the fact that it's not a membership party, and many other reasons make it unreformable. It will always be a tool of the corporations, originally a tool of the slave owners, then a tool of the big corporations, and so on. But as far as what splits off from the Democratic Party, in terms of mostly voters, but also in terms of even some leaders, that is an open question. And there are some people that obviously should split from the Democratic Party and could play a positive role in building a socialist movement. One example I'll give that will tie into something we already mentioned is Cornel West, a noted African-American scholar. He's taught at Harvard, Princeton, back at Harvard again. Always been, as far as I remember, I meant to do some formal research. I only know Cornel West from actually running into him a couple times and talking with him and then reading about him in the corporate media. By the way, very nice man, very interesting person to talk with, obviously. I haven't done the Wikipedia Cornel West or whatever. I should have done that for the show. But what I know of Cornel West, he's always been on the left. And he's also supported Democratic DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, which supports the Democratic Party. That may be changing, but that's the way it is now. And that part I didn't agree with him on. You know, I'm like, you know, some with your critique of a radical critique and socialist critique in many respects, why would you support the Democratic Party? Well, lately it seems Cornel West is moving away from that, and he could play a huge role in building a party for the 99%, a party for the masses of people in this country. And he is pushing that right now openly, saying we need a people's party. He's moved away. He seems to have moved away from the Democratic Party. And we're pushing, using all his authority in the left and his erudition and so on, and saying we need a people's party. We need a party for working people. And he just endorsed Ginger Jensen, the social alternative candidate in Minneapolis. So this is brilliant. And there's people like Cornel West who had been, you know, mostly in the parameters of the Democratic Party, or the orbit of it. You can't really be in it. You can't really be a member of it. But, you know, saying that's the way forward, saying that's the solution, that's the lesser evil, whatever the arguments are. He seems to have moved beyond that decisively, like many, many others have. Now, in his case, he's a leader. He's a well-known figure. And that's an interesting thing that has to be taken into account, is that there are going to be some leaders, maybe even Sanders. I mean, it's not ruled out. It's very unlikely, not ruled out, that Sanders, under the pressure of a movement, could actually become a... Thank you for beeping your horn so loud out there. Anyway, like, Sanders could become part of the, you know, different streams that would form a new party for working people, a party of the 99%, a mass left party, whatever the phrase, a people's party, whatever the phrase is that best describe that as it develops. I would think it would be somewhat anti-capitalist, would be progressive, maybe wholly anti-capitalist, maybe socialist. You know, we'll see. By the way, we're approaching that hour mark where we have to say legally for the FCC, this is WMFO, WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And go to WMFO.org, I'll just add on, to listen anytime by your computer. And if